Yeah, the White Sox invent ways to lose games.
Oh, man. The trip to Chicago could be coming at the perfect time.
And the Red Sox lose again to the Chicago White Sox, who had lost 8 consecutive games coming into this series, 121 times last year. And the Red Sox have a lot of things they need to figure out here.
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to a new episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, April 13, 2025, as we record this show. The Chicago White Sox entered the weekend 2-10 and on a 8-game losing streak. They finished the weekend winning back-to-back games for the first time this season and earning their first series win against the Boston Red Sox team, who is clearly not clicking on all cylinders. In a way, the Red Sox are very fortunate to not have been swept by the White Sox this weekend. We'll recap this weekend with cap tips to the White Sox pitching staff, an impressive debut from Chase Mydroth, and Luis Robert Jr. coming through in the clutch in one of the White Sox wins. Also, preview the upcoming series against the Sacramento Athletics, which could be a good test for White Sox pitchers. Checking around Major League Baseball as Justin Steele is out for the season. That's a big blow to the Chicago Cubs starting staff. And the Minnesota Twins are stumbling out of the gates. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Feegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, gents. The White Sox win a series a lot earlier than last year. In our previous podcast episode, 2025 felt like 2024, especially in the first 12 games. But the White Sox win a series against an American League East opponent. This time it's the Boston Red Sox. And James, what I think is the most impressive thing out of this weekend for the White Sox is that this Boston offense has got a lot of potential. But in 3 games against the White Sox, they only scored 6 runs. And I feel like this team is at its best when Martin Perez and Shane Smith are on the mound. Like, I'm starting to get a growing confidence that the White Sox are going to play well enough to not only be competitive, but maybe steal some wins against some better teams in the league. Is there a quiet confidence within the White Sox clubhouse when Martin Perez and Shane Smith are on the bump?
I don't know if I can quite do this quiet confidence narrative. I haven't tapped into that enough, but I think there's both like confidence that both are pretty good. Martin is, you know, obviously very experienced and been around for a bit. So while the way he's pitched has kind of been surprisingly good, I think there's probably a general concept that he knows how to keep teams in games. And like, you're not going to see him getting run out in the third, like every other time, or generally other inconsistencies that you could expect from like a struggling rookie trying to establish themselves. And Smith's stuff was pretty much the talk of spring about how good it was. So I think everyone in the clubhouse kind of acknowledges like, this is the guy throwing really hard and also throwing a pretty nutty changeup. Like, about all the changeup projects they had this spring, he's probably the best result so far. And I think everyone's kind of aware of that. So I definitely think with what they're doing, they stand out, or they have been playing just games where they're in it and they can feel like they're a competitive major league team when they're starting. But, you know, I think everyone kind of, at least the coaching staff for sure, I would imagine players too, feel pretty good about Davis Martin in general. So, I think they'd probably say positive things about Jonathan Cannon too, and Sean Burke, but just obviously they've struggled a bit more noticeably in 2 of their 3 starts than the others. But yeah, I think those are probably 2 of the top dogs so far, but kind of get there in different ways and different reasons.
And James mentioned Davis Martin, Jim, and Davis had a really good start. The Dart went 6 innings, allowed just 6 hits, 1 earned run against the Red Sox with 6 strikeouts to 1 walk on 89 pitches. Davis Martin was 16 for 25 in first pitch strikes against the Red Sox lineup. Jim, what worked for Davis Martin? Because this was a nice bounce back performance from his previous start.
I think the first pitch strike, setting up counts in his favor, being able to use the changeup more, having better changeups. I think that was the more close to the idea that he'd been building in terms of arsenal and how it's used. The first start was kind of a little bit strikeout poor. I mean, yeah, the results are fine, but a little bit subject to bad luck. And then, you know, struggled second time out, but third time, just it's kind of what you want in terms of being able to use more of the zone, being able to use the changeup to get either weak contact or swings and misses versus, you know, spitting on it, getting off the fastball. So I think that's kind of what, especially against lefties, you know, having that weapon to neutralize them. I think that's kind of what the idea is.
And for the White Sox bullpen, that was a part of this series that I was really worried about. But they really stepped up. And with Will Venable, no matter what the situation was with Rafael Devers, James, Venable managed it like you still had loogies. Like relievers could just only come in for one batter. And maybe it's just how it was for timing-wise, but like Mike Clevenger would come in the game, get two outs. Here's Rafael Devers. Automatic pull. We got to get a lefty in there to face Devers. And I guess that we talked about that in a couple of podcast episodes ago about how Venable and learning from him managing the bullpen. I guess I'm going to assume if there's any left-handed power bat like Rafael Devers in Major League Baseball, and they have any type of struggles, again, same side pitching against lefties, that we could see more Cam Boozers, even Tyler Gilbert's as well. Brandon Eichert is currently in the bullpen coming in to just try to get that one out.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to run out of them with this group, so you might as well smoke them. I think kind of outside of maybe Bryce Wilson, and even then he hasn't been like working multiple innings when he's in high leverage, or outside Mike Vassell, who obviously works multiple innings, but not so more explicitly a long reliever. You're not really going to see anyone working in leverage like multi-innings. They don't have that sort of monster in there. So everyone's going to be working in pockets, and it'd be hard to see that given how a little matchup limited a lot of their relievers are, to really see them working beyond like a 3-4 hitter pocket, because one, opposing teams are not going to leave it that right-hand dominant where, like, you know, Jordan Leisure just pitches like two innings like all the time, or you're just going to be flipping through those options so much that everyone's kind of outies are shorter, because everyone's like, well, we think he can get through these 3-4 hitters here, and if he does, then he still gets replaced after an inning, or if he doesn't, you know, we're not gonna like wait around and watch the inning implode upon a matchup that doesn't work for him.
And I like that strategy, Jim, because again, there's just we're still learning about this White Sox bullpen. There is no lockdown guy that the White Sox currently have. I think Pat Murphy, though, is going to pitch in 80 games this year, how he's currently on pace. But I do like, as far as the way that Venable has managed the bullpen, even though it may not be the best results, just because of the talent on hand.
Yeah, I think it's the safe way to manage. If you look at deploying pitchers in terms of putting them in a position to succeed versus taking chances in bad matchups, I think he's trying to do right by them. I think there tends to introduce an element of panic when you make so many mid-inning pitching changes or use so many arms. I think this is a case where perhaps the group is new enough and the season's early enough to where it doesn't feel maybe that desperate yet, as like a Rick Renteria four-pitcher inning that we used to see on semi-regular occasion, or too regularly, I guess, to where it was a thing. But, you know, that's always, I think, the fear is that, yeah, the more pitchers you use, the more pitcher, yeah, the greater the chance you find the guy who doesn't have it that day. But given the early struggles, you can understand the apprehension of trying to, get too much from somebody. I also think the arrival of Gilbert has calmed things down a little bit. Like, he's been impressive his first couple of games. He only had to pick off a runner on a Sunday. Didn't even have to face a batter, just picked him off. But I think that was probably more in line than what, you know, Brandon Eichert might offer in terms of a left-handed reliever, although Eichert's back because Ellard's on the injured list. But that was probably more of the original mix, was having him there. And now that he's back, it feels like it's one more arm who's done it before. And I think that's kind of important with this mix right now.
So the White Sox pitching against the Red Sox, really impressive. Again, just 6 runs in 3 games. Well done to the White Sox pitching side. Offensively, feast or famine. The White Sox finally did win a game, but they didn't have to score 8 or more runs. Now, it was cool on Friday. That was a very entertaining game to be in the seats to watch the White Sox win by double digits. put up 11 runs against the Red Sox and watch Boston Red Sox Twitter have a meltdown. But Saturday, they came through, won a very tight game, 3-2, thanks to Brooks Baldwin's walk-off hit. And Luis Robert set that up for him. We'll talk about Robert in a moment. But Chase Meidroth, impressive debut, 3-for-7. He scored 3 times. He had 3 walks to just 1 strikeout. Offensively, we'll talk about that in a second. But I have to bring up defensively. And James, I love how hard Chase Meidroth is trying to make shortstop work. When the ball is hit to him, he fields it cleanly. He makes the throws. But we saw him at second base, and getting, from my point of view, watching Meidroth at second and at short, he's not a shortstop, but I think he can be an average or better than average second baseman defensively because he made some impressive plays. How long are we going to see Meidroth at shortstop? Did you get any insight on what the defensive plans are for him?
They said he mixed in there a little bit. They never committed to him being there full time. He played shortstop a lot through spring. He got a lot, at least on the record, endorsements about the idea of him being able to mix in there. There's never been like a full throated endorsement of like, let's play him every day and accommodate to do it. And I think a lot of that is because a lot of the plan A publicly is still that Colson Montgomery will be the everyday shortstop and for a long period of time. So obviously that's not the case right now. And this would be possibly one of many pockets that even in a Colson Montgomery realizes his ceiling world, Meidroth would need to mix in there at some point, but it doesn't seem like you're going to carve that out right now. I mean, we saw Amaya get a little bit of playing time. I mean, plenty of people didn't think Amaya would survive the addition of Meidroth to the roster at all. So the fact that he's still in there kind of endorses that they feel him at least starting against left-handers and just playing in matchups that they don't feel is necessarily good for Lenin Sosa or maybe Miguel Vargas, or just any time of this rest for them where they might switch it down to where Meidroth plays shortstop. Obviously, Brooks Baldwin's requirements get more complicated by the day and injury. And even you know, he picks up extra responsibilities just through the activities of pregame stretch somehow. So they've said he's going to mix in there. I think they're a little bit shy defensively of like, yes, everyday shortstop, because I think if somebody truly projected to be plus there with a bat that was going to stick it up, maybe that would simplify kind of their long-term decisions. They'd be like, well, we like think Colson can play a shortstop, but Jacob Gonzalez is just so clearly ready to go. But we don't have that sort of thing forcing your hand right now where you can make a clear decision. And I don't think necessarily Chase disproves that, but I do think they're going to continue to mix him in there. Okay. So I think he more likely is going to play shortstop than like Lenin Sosa is going to go back there or even Nick Maton. So I think he's a notch above them on that ladder. Well, Amaya clearly still has like the chief defensive value that has him still on this team right now.
They turned some really impressive double plays over the weekend, Meidroth and Amaya. But offensively, Jim, when does Meidroth start batting leadoff? Because the dude gets on base. They're not putting that pressure on him right now, but watching the top of the White Sox lineup outside of Friday and Saturday and Sunday, they really could use someone that gets on base to be batting leadoff. And I do wonder, maybe not this upcoming week, but maybe in the next couple of weeks, we do see Meidroth bat leadoff.
I think you could try it sooner. You know, I don't think you have to anoint him leadoff guy. Like, you are our on base hope in your first week in the, in the majors. And, if you can't do it, we're screwed. But, you know, I always go back to Jim Leland being somebody who would like take a rookie and bat him leadoff. And his point of view was, hey, you're in the big leagues now. You're gonna get big league responsibilities. And so just some, it would drive Tigers fans nuts, especially during like the Saber 1.0 or it might be with Saber 1.0 discussions of just, you know, lineups and the idea of who should be a leadoff man versus who's batting the bottom of the order. And you know, why is this AAA guy with a 304 OBP batting leadoff? And Leland would just say like, yeah, just it's because I don't want him to think he's being hidden or that he's being mitigated or that, you know, I think less of him. He's wearing a uniform. You know, we're going to throw him out there and just show some belief. And you know, Leland's in the Hall of Fame now, so obviously that didn't sink his career or a bunch of people who played for him. So, you know, if Mydroth makes sense and it's a good matchup, if he's not, you know, facing, you know, righty with massive slider to where that just destroys righties and he looks in over his head, like, sure, put him out there. If it goes 0-for-4, but it's like a normal pedestrian 0-for-4, do it again. Just, you know, don't make a big deal out of it is what I would say. Just because this lineup is so, yeah, it fluctuates so greatly because their plan A's and plan B's and plan C's are all getting hurt or staying hurt, as it were, in some cases, that this is the time to try stuff and maybe handle a little bit more responsibility in the name of, well, who else is going to play there? And yeah, like, you know, kind of Brooks Baldwin now in right field when Joshua Palacios is out there, just be like, yeah, I guess Brooks Baldwin over, you know, when it was, you know, the first week of the season, I thought that was too soon. But now that you're down to guys in AAA that you signed, not even for opening day, getting major league starts in the outfield, or you have Greg Jones out there, just sure, I guess Brooks Baldwin can go. And it doesn't, it's more of an all hands on deck situation versus throwing it on his plate and seeing if it breaks. And so, yeah, if as long as he doesn't look overwhelmed, give him the opportunity to just have a quietly unremarkable day.
James, how did Mydroth look at the plate to you being at the stadium?
He looked like what Chase Mydroth was promised to be. It was a lot of low line or ground ball contact and or, you know, taking walks. Something they said, at least, and, you know, he's been a little cagey about what, like, the big adjustment with him has been. You know, he talks about a little bit more like activating the pull side, which we certainly saw in Charlotte. The White Sox have talked more about, like, being aggressive in the zone. His approach is very passive just overall. You know, he's not a huge in-zone swinger on top of being a very judicious out-of-zone swinger. But so in that respect, his first hit was him ambushing a fastball. He had a couple other first pitch swings that's showing he's willing to do that. I don't think that should be like a Sisyphus-like situation where he can't just get him more aggressive. It seems like it's more him understanding with time. And obviously, even AAA, but especially like an A-ball in college, I think there's kind of a benefit to just working every count deep because your pitcher is more likely to break down and throw a mistake at some point if you just string them on longer. Whereas the command level in MLB or major leagues, not just the MLB, I don't want to get a semantic umbrella. But anyway, at the major league level, that's not necessarily going to be to your benefit. It's kind of like more the situation of you're going to get one and either you're going to wait for the one, or if you don't swing at the one early on, you're going to not get it again. So I think it's more just him gradually adjusting to that and showed some signs of doing it. I don't know how much of the Charlotte power is going to show up. We haven't seen him like drive and elevate a ball so far. Obviously, if he can really translate what he did OBP wise from AAA, you don't need any more power theoretically. If a guy has like a 400 OBP and a 300 slugging, like especially on this White Sox offense, like you can make it work. It's just that we expect some level of degradation from how much he was able to just dominate the count and dominate the zone in AAA that you feel like you need to add something to it. So far he's just doing what he did in AAA in the majors. So that doesn't necessarily answer our questions, but we also haven't seen a breakdown of what he does well up here that he needs to add more power to make it work. So other than, yeah, you can hit a liner over his head, or he's not going to run, you know, cover 30 feet to his, you know, glove side necessarily on a play. All just things we kind of knew about him already were the only flaws I would say that are exposed on him.
Yeah, we'll see what Mydroth does, but it is an impressive debut. White Sox fans, we're excited, especially on Friday, on how that game went out for Mydroth and really positive outcome for Chase Mydroth in his first weekend in the majors. Moving over to Luis Robert. So Jim, in our previous podcast episode, we talked about outside of a season ending injury, are the White Sox facing the worst case scenario with Luis Robert having a really slow start to the season? Cause again, the end game is try to trade Luis Robert to a contender before the trade deadline. USA Today's reporter Bob Nightingale and frequent White Sox mouthpiece wrote in his Sunday column that discussions between the Dodgers and White Sox have tabled, in which I guess the Dodgers were floating James Outman, which, whatever. I didn't take that very seriously, but the trade rumors are going to continue for Luis Robert all the way up to the deadline. But on Saturday, with the White Sox down 2-0, I thought that was a big moment for Luis Robert to come through. The wind was blowing in from right field, but he was still able to hit an opposite field home run to tie the game. And in the ninth inning, he reached on base against Aroldis Chapman. He stole second base, and then he scored off Brooks Baldwin's pinch hit single to left field. And I think Saturday is just, he still has it. Like, Robert still has the star ability where in a tight game, he can take over and win the game for the White Sox. And I thought that was a really good sign, and hopefully a sign that he's going to break out of this slump.
Yeah, I feel like my perspective was validated at least for a weekend, which is, you know, I'll take it sometimes when it comes to trying to take the optimistic side of any White Sox development over the last year and a half, that you have to take your wins. But yeah, the fact that he's moving so well, that he's running so aggressively and freely, I think that means a lot just because of his wide ranging set of skills. Like, his plate discipline seems like it's okay. You know, it hasn't manifested itself in, you know, incredible offense yet, but, you know, the homer was, you know, in the, you know, the late game at bats all looked under control. They all looked like he had some semblance of what he was doing. A game plan didn't look like he was trying to overdo it and laid on fastballs like he was last year. So, you know, when you have the ability to go opposite field for a homer, and you have the ability to steal bases, and, you know, he's up to six right now, and that speed also translates to the outfield. A lot of ways for him to affect the game, and, you know, he has the strength to be a 30 homer guy, and so you want to see him at least hit 20, and you're going to, what was it, 200 and something plate appearances without a homer.
Yeah, it was a long stretch.
Yeah. Obviously, that's unacceptable, and I think that was a big reason why the White, you know, among the big reasons why the White Sox were so awful last year. But you know, I think there's talent here to where, come trade deadline or sooner, as long as he stays healthy, and knock on wood, that's always the issue. But there's a lot of ways a team can use him that, you know, even if they're not counting on him being MVP offensively, like, I'm thinking like a team like the Phillies could obviously use it. Yeah. A guy like Roberts, you know, he's somebody, even if he's not hitting all cylinders at the plate, he does enough, and he does enough on the base paths, and he does enough defensively to really give that team something else. So yeah, I'm optimistic on him so far. I also think that the top flight prospect they're talking about in return was Dalton Rushing as part of the all catchers return. You know, every trade should have a catcher back, and just to keep adding challengers to Edgar Caro, because, you know, it looks like, you know, Kyle Teal's made him mad based on the way he's hitting so far. And so, yeah, just keep ramping it up. Every catcher they add gives them 50 points of OPS.
James, on that point that Jim brought up, that Robert has six stolen bases, that's second most in Major League Baseball so far. Does Robert just have a green light? Is that the idea for the White Sox? Like, yeah, man, when you get on base, run wild.
I mean, Corey Lee might have a green light. I mean, not right now with his ankle, but like, the team's approach is like aggression. I think like the
it's
idea
not fast, is it? We're not bringing back fast.
Well,
James, we're not bringing back fast, are they?
Let me gather myself. All right. when Jim made the simulation of like all Chris Getz teams, obviously that wasn't great. However,
yeah, better than the outcome.
Getz started his like little availability on Friday, and I appreciate that this is near and dear to his heart, because he was a good base runner in his time. It was probably like his, you know, most standout plus skill. Like, he was a good fielder, like, obviously versatile, but like, he was a good base dealer, especially like for his speed. He's very efficient. So I know he means it when he talked about like being angry that like they weren't so good on their like leads, and like seeing how inefficient they were and how much they were leaving on the bone. But it's still striking, especially like because they talked pregame Friday. So like, it's the in the middle of the 8-game losing streak, and he begins the presser by talking about leads, like his little opening statement about like what he's pleased with.
things that I've talked about from the beginning in regards to measuring success of this season. Really happy of where our leads are. We're in the top 10 in the league in regards to primary leads. Obviously, over time, that's going to lead to more runs, run production. Offensively, our swing decisions have been at the top of the league as well, which is a testament to the process that we've put in place and the execution of these players. Obviously, it hasn't showed up in the win and loss column, but we know over time that we're certainly on the right track.
I know this is like an emphasis to the team. When he transitioned to like talking about like them chasing less, I was like, okay, good. I think like all the TV cameras here are probably going to be able to latch on to like the offense is swinging at better pitches and explain that more to like, the 30-second news bite on the end of the TV local news, and they're talking about like the White Sox secondary leads. I feel like viewers could be like, what? What are we talking about here? As much as like, it's good. Like they want to be an organization that focuses on little things like that. It was like an interesting lead message, but I think it speaks to how they look at their base running and certainly what they've emphasized in talking about, talking to Jason Bourgeois in the spring training about it was like, they want to be super aggressive on taking the extra base. So I think, especially with how often they're playing behind or how often they're like in close games or just like one run for an inning seems like a good outcome for what they have lined up. I think most of the time the math is going to be, yes, Luis Robert should steal, and they're going to tell him to do that. I think the thing that would slow it down is if he's not feeling good. So him running around, as he said, post game when we asked him about it, is that like, he's feeling good. And if anything, he added on, like, I'm obviously not hitting right now. I'm glad I'm able to contribute in this way. So it definitely affects the Luis Robert, but like you're seeing Brooks Baldwin run pretty often, often on hit and runs. But I think there's the threshold at times with previous White Sox, like 2021, 2022. I don't think it was really clear, especially in times when like Tim Anderson was dealing with sore legs. I don't know how many people really were above the threshold for stealing bases beyond Luis Robert. I think it's going to be like, I think Jacob Mamayo might take off if he's on base and the opportunity arrives. I think any of their little fast guys or even like little average runner guys or even, Corey Lee is probably going to, like, if he's healthy, obviously, are going to be taking off more often than not. You probably would see Michael Taylor go off to the races. Like, I think they're just going to be a team where like anyone where it seems like viable, they're going to probably be running pretty often because they haven't been scoring.
Michael Justin Taylor actually has the green light as well, it seems.
Within reason, he didn't wave Brooks Baldwin five steps from third base while the best right field arm in the American League was loading up. So that there are limits. We found them.
That was a good stop by Jersey. Cap tip to Michael Taylor. He went 3-for-4 on Friday. And he picked up a stolen base as well. I've noticed as well, like when the White Sox have runners on the corners, they're going to send that runner from first to second base, especially under two outs. And opposing teams are not throwing down to second base. So why not grab the extra 90 feet when you can? It's the opposing teams in the back of their mind that first and third for the White Sox, they're going to send that runner to second. You better be sure, or that runner from third is definitely coming home. So have to make sure that everything's lined up defensively if the catcher wants to take on that risk of throwing down to second base. All right. So all positive things so far. It is the Sox Machine podcast. Let's bring up something that's concerning. Jim Margulis, when is it time to call up Tim Elko?
You don't believe in Andrew Vaughn?
Jacob Amaya has a higher batting average right now than Andrew Vaughn. Now, Andrew Vaughn did single in his last at bat against Aroldis Chapman. Famously, Vaughn has good success against Chapman. But to start the year, Vaughn is 6-for-53. He has a 383 OPS. His on-base percentage is 175, and he continues to bat cleanup. I'm a little dumbfounded here, and if it doesn't pick up, I don't know what the White Sox are going to do.
Yeah, I think with Vaughn, I think given the weather, he's somebody who might be more disproportionately affected by bad wind currents or cold weather, just because I don't think he generates the natural leverage to drive the ball. Like, that's something I think that stood out to me as we're watching him in his rookie year, second year, as he's developing. there were never really any easy homers. Like even with Luis Robert, that opposite field homer he hit, it didn't seem like he got all of it. Cole Day still got the ball. It still had the natural strength, still had the natural levers and leverage to get the ball over the fence at the favorable part of the park. So we've seen Eloy Jimenez do that. Even like Tim Anderson, like could occasionally poke the ball to right field, like when he had his legs under him. And it seems like Vaughn just needs to have everything lined up to get the ball out of the park. And so it strikes me as the production will get better when it gets warmer or the winds change, but also it reflects the ceiling that he's been operating under the whole time, and that like he just needs everything going right to be okay. And when something is off, when it's a case of not feeling his best when he's playing the outfield, or just trying to expand the zone too much and swinging at too many pitches that are pitcher's pitches and really not being able to drive the ball, or even when he drives the ball sometimes just doesn't go as far as he needs it to go, I think this is the the end result. So it sounds like an excuse, but it's only like a half excuse. I don't expect him to be this bad all year, but I also don't think, like, we've seen it for years now that just the payoff never quite arrives.
Yeah, I mean, he's gonna have to go on a heater in these next 47 at bats just to have a respectable batting average. I mean, this is a really poor start for Andrew Vaughn. I would like him to not be batting the middle of the order, but that's not going to happen. He's definitely going to be batting fourth.
Just to say, like, I asked about Andrew Vaughn. I was talking to Marcus Thames this weekend, and he quoted his expected stats back to me, which is worth noting. Don't kill the messenger, but his ex-woba is 341, which would be a career high. His ex-woba on contact is 437, which would be a career high. His hard hit rate is currently a career high. So they are saying he is hitting the ball hard, things will snap into form for him eventually. We're not as worried about this as we were last year. Now, of course, last year they weren't saying like, oh, we're worried about him. They'd just be like, he'll figure it out. So obviously you can talk about the hindsight of like, oh yeah, this is nowhere near close to that in terms of concern. It's a lot easier to say that, but that's kind of the at least what they're telling me is that, hey, look at the expected stats, he'll be fine. It's been 15 games. Chill out.
I think I am going to kill the messenger here.
What?
Because, I see that. And people are going to reference the stat. Like, when you take actual slugging percentage and minus expected slugging percentage, there is a suggestion that Andrew Vaughn is the second unluckiest hitter right now in Major League Baseball. And, yeah, he is hitting the ball hard on the ground, and suddenly he's not hitting fastballs. That's the thing that's just mind-blowing. Right now, to start the year, in 24 plate appearances that ended with a fastball, Andrew Vaughn is 2-for-22. That's never been the case. That's been his bread and butter throughout his entire career. That's the one thing you can count on, is Andrew Vaughn hitting the fastball, and he's not doing so. And I'm wrong. Right now, Vaughn is ground ball rate. Shockingly, he's only 42.9%. So to Jim's credit, he's just not strong enough to take advantage of the spring weather in Chicago and hit it deep enough to hit home runs at one of the most home run hitter friendly ballparks in Major League Baseball. If he's hitting the ball more in the air and this is the result, I don't know what you do with him, because this is clearly unacceptable. Or maybe if you continue to have this entire season, he bats 220 in 2025, you got to move on. You got to move on. You can find better hitting first basemen who are not zero war, who are not undersized for the position. So there you go. That's my rant against Andrew Vaughn, the biweekly segment that we have in the Sox Machine podcast. One last thing about this series, Garrett Crochet returned, struck out 11, and I really thought, James, at one point he was going to throw a no-hitter against the White Sox lineup. Getting a chance to chat with Crochet, what was it like for Crochet returning back to Chicago?
Chilling out with the homies, given how much of a torture, like, metaphor I made in the pregame notes, which I have to say I'm always rushing through very much. So if you see goofy thoughts in there ahead of time, I'm sorry. This is like if there's a post-credit scene and like Matt Damon's character from Good Will Hunting comes back and just like hangs out with his old buddies for like a weekend, and then like does like a math problem that they can't understand, and like then drives off into the sunset and goes back to his happy life. He said it wasn't like a big thing in his focus in terms of, you know, having an extra edge to it. He said, if anything, and don't take this the wrong way, that he was doing kind of a slowly throttling up his stuff over the course of the game. He kind of felt like he like got through three innings and didn't really have to pull out a bunch of stuff, and he wasn't reaching back for extra velo, he said post game. The one thing he did say is that like he was very cognizant of a no hitter very early and very much was trying to get it. So he thought it was funny that Chase Mindrop was the one who hit it off him. But he very much like the reaction you had of seeing him drop to his knees and like be disappointed. He was gunning for it. He knew he wanted it and it was going. He had kind of a blessing and a curse. He felt like it pushed him to be better, but also was something he was probably thinking about consciously more than they recommend anyone to ever try to think about a no hitter. He said as much on Friday that that's his goal for every game. It's like, no hitter. He used colorful language that I don't know if it would change our podcast classification to quote him directly. But yeah, I take it how you will. But Garrett said it wasn't like a big thing to taste his old, or he doesn't feel like weird about being separation, because I feel like with the way the White Sox are and the way who they traded him to and the fact that they'd done this before, it just kind of felt like him getting, you know, graduating, really, like going up to a higher level. And it's not like this rivalry or he's sore at them or the White Sox gave up on him. It's almost like he got too good for the White Sox and got traded up to like a higher level. So he didn't tie those two feelings together with, oh yeah, I'm definitely getting a no hitter today. But I don't know, take your own assumptions for why he felt so locked in on that. Like in this encounter with the White Sox, obviously he didn't get it, like not even with it and three outs. So I wasn't worried, right? Were you? Like,
yeah, I was.
He didn't cross the Danny Wright line.
I'm mostly doing false confidence, but I did think like there's no way the Red Sox want him to throw this many pitches. And Alex Cora said post game, like, I've never been so happy for someone to give up a hit.
Well, Crochet will get another shot against the White Sox to throw a no hitter next weekend when the White Sox visit the Boston Red Sox. But the White Sox are currently 4-11, but they got their first series win against Boston this past weekend. Next weekend, Sox Machine will be hosting a White Sox watch party at the Remova Loft inside the Remova Theater off 35th in the Bridgeport neighborhood of Chicago on Saturday, April 19th, starting at 3 p.m. Central Time. Watch the White Sox battle the Red Sox on Remova's 20-foot video wall. We'll have baseball trivia going on between innings and baseball bingo throughout the game where you can win prizes. Remova Brewery will be having a beer launch that day, and there's always the delicious food from the Remova Grill. The event is free and kids are welcome, so if you have problems getting CHSN to work on your antenna or on the app, forget those stresses and come down to the Remova Loft for the Sox Machine Watch Party on Saturday, April 19th. We now shift gears as the Chicago White Sox welcome the Sacramento Athletics for three games at Wrigley Field. And your pitching probables for this series, Tuesday night, 6:40 p.m. Central Time. This is Jackie Robinson Day for Major League Baseball. It's also $5 ballpark food day. So if you go to the game, lots of food items for just $5 at Wrigley Field for the White Sox and A's. For the A's, it'll be left-handed starting pitching Jeffrey Springs against Sean Burke for the White Sox. Wednesday at 6:40 p.m. Central Time, Osvaldo Beto for the A's against Jonathan Cannon. And then on getaway day Thursday, 1:10 p.m. Central Time, J.P. Sears against Davis Martin. And James, maybe you feel a bit different, but with me being in the stands at Section 108 and the season tickets, with you being in the press box, I am enjoying the vibes early for the home games with the White Sox at Wrigley Field. I'm not saying it's like overly optimistic, but there is buzz when good things are happening. And so far, the White Sox are 4-5 at home this year compared to last year when they were 23-58, which is a 28% winning percentage. So 72% of the time, White Sox fans came to the stadium last year expecting a loss and got to see that. But I wonder if this team is going to beat expectations, even our lowly expectations when we made our season predictions. I look back at 2017 and 2019, because in 2017, the White Sox were 39-42 at home. And in 2019, they were 39-41. Maybe it's a stretch for this White Sox team to play that well at home. But the better they play at home and the more wins they generate, maybe, I think that's could that possibly lead for this White Sox organization to get more buy-in from fans? Understanding that, yeah, we may still struggle on the road, but when you buy tickets and you come for the giveaways and you stay, we're going to play a lot better baseball at home and we're going to increase our winning percentage this season at home.
It could. I don't know what they would do to reliably deliver such a thing, because they're not really built to their ballpark in any sort of super traditional way. Like, they can't hit for power, and it's a power hitting park. Their staff is not truly ground ball oriented so much as like they're, we can't strike that many people out oriented. They don't have too many like power sinkers where they can just expect it to be ground balls. They kind of just like any part of the strike zone we think you're not covering, we are hoping that when we throw something 50 grade there, you'll pop it up some reason. I don't think they're necessarily built there, other than if you just think, well, the trajectory can't move. They have it in Chicago. They don't have it in the road. And that's like the big thing. As much as they're excited to have it, I don't quite get people talking it up on that scale where it's like, we're going to play 200 percentage points better at home because of it. And I don't think their offense has really reflected that either. Yeah, I think that would be good. I think they're still kind of years away from that being the sort of offense that they roll out. And really, I don't know if it's the offense they're building in any form. Like, even the power hitter prospects on this team are like athletic in a way where they're going to play defense. They're not really building, you know, with Getz and Barfield and Giannis, you know, this, they're all building these kind of, they're building it in their own image where it's all these versatile multi-position guys. And I don't know how much they'll ever become like that softball, like fly ball team that they were points in the early 2000s, where it's all around homers and built to their ballpark. They're all about kind of building this versatile style. So I don't know if they'll be better at home before they're just better in general. Too much more immobile equipment is a big factor for them beyond like the direct machine.
Last year, they're out-homered at home 101-64. This year, they're actually up 10-6. They've actually hit all 10 of their homers at home. So there's a little bit in terms of, if we're going to hit them out of the park anywhere, it's going to be here. I think the hope is that they show a little bit more power to where they're not getting out-homered. What is 8-0 on the road is right now the deficit. And if you multiply that or extrapolate that over the rest of the season, that's a lot to zero. And that's not what you want. So, but at least early on, the fact that they're winning games and the homer column is in their favor, at least like the wins as they stand are not fluky. The fact that they might eventually get out homered at home, like once the winds change and the more the schedule rolls into town, perhaps pitchers get injured. Like if the White Sox have a injury in the rotation, based on the way Charlotte's rotation has started, like all the walks at the spot starter level, that it's going to be pretty tricky to fill those holes. So that, I think that's where my fear is. But when you look at the run differential and you look at the scores they've been able to put up, they've at least earned it. It's not like they're getting out homered and then, but still outscoring somehow, because all the homers they allow are solo shots and the two homers they hit have been grand slams. At least there is something logical underneath it.
I don't know how sustainable it is, but I will note they have successfully quarantined their most 2024 moments to road games. Like, they did not do the five relievers get five outs game in front of the home fans. I'm glad lose a game on a walk-off hamstring pull did not happen in front of home fans. That would not be like, because there's no announcer at the home games. You're just watching confusing events unfold and trying to, you know, your mixture of like shock and horror are just going through your mind at the same time with no explanations. Like, I was in the bleachers when they won on the Adam Dunn like walk off balk, and that was difficult to explain to people around me. And that was a good thing. I can only imagine when it's chaos and people are panicking. And they've done a good job with that for whatever reason.
Yeah, if Talkman pulled up lame going home at Guaranteed Rate Field, all the jokes would have been that he got shot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a fun playback. I still don't have any words. I've never seen that before. Poor Mike Tauchman. But again, the White Sox are playing it better at home. Just better vibes right now at the stadium for fans. Hopefully that keeps up. The A's, by the way, homeless, or at least they have temporary homes renting in Sacramento. They're currently 2-7 this season in Sacramento. They're 4-3 away from Sacramento. So for this season, the A's are 6-10 as they stroll into Chicago. And hopefully this is a winning homestand for the White Sox, and we have more positive things to report and chat about on Thursday night when we record the next episode of the Sox Machine podcast. But now we're going to transition over to around Major League Baseball like we do for the Monday shows. What is catching our attention around the league? Jim, I'll start with you. What's caught your attention around Major League Baseball?
Well, I'm not going to take yours because you told us what it was, and that was very much front of mind for me because I'm kind of fascinated by the dynamic. Well,
let's do talk about that because okay. The Minnesota Twins right now, and somebody tweeted this at me after Saturday's win for the White Sox, that the White Sox were not in last place, and I couldn't believe it, Jim. I'm like, who is doing worse than the White Sox? The Minnesota Twins are 3-10 against everyone else, not the White Sox, and this really feels like after the offseason and all the financial stuff, it's just continuing into the regular season for the Twins, Jim.
Yeah, they've been winning at like a 40-something win clip, I think, over the last 2 months of last season, basically like when their collapse started, into this year. And they've had, you know, between the Pollad situation, trying to sell Justin Ishbia withdrawing from consideration or pulling his bid, and then trying to find new sellers. But also sounds like one of the Pollads still wants to be in charge, kind of like maybe Mark Cuban style, like when Cuban sold the Mavericks but still had a decision-making stake until apparently that was pulled off from under him with the Luka trade. But this is not the podcast for that. But there's been this... To me, I think I mentioned it in our kind of division previews and just talking about the landscape is just the sense of decay with the Twins that, without fresh investment, Rocco Baldelli's still there, and he's never really impressed me as a problem solver. Like, they've had some teams just kind of get sunk by starters not being able to go past the five innings, or, just the same guys getting injured, and just they never seem to be prepared for the most logical outcomes from the way they build the team. And, perhaps he can do anything anyway, and it's not necessarily him, but he's been there the whole time, and they've had a lot of disappointing or underwhelming performances. The front office has been the same, and you're just seeing like less and less money and less fan interest, the way their attendance has dropped because of this lack of investment. Just it all seems like it's just slowly rotting away, and nobody's really interested in doing anything about it because they're just waiting for somebody else to take over and be the money people. And this is kind of what it looks like. And we saw that too at the White Sox, just when the late stage White Sox with Kenny Williams and Rick Hahn, that administration just running to its very logical end of just the one idea they might have had between them not working anymore, and it all falling apart in spectacular fashion. Like, it makes sense that the Twins would follow suit, and maybe not to such a severe extent because the White Sox, I think, have some very idiosyncratic tendencies. But still, just the same kind of thematic consistency of here's what happens when you just run out the same players. In the case of like Carlos Santana moving from, being one of their better Twins last year and then moving to a division rival and not really doing anything to replace him, it stands to reason that they would just get further behind.
Really good points, Jim. And I mean, if they're kind of following late stage White Sox era of Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams, I wonder what when the bottom falls out for the Minnesota Twins, what that looks like, because they have some, in my opinion, immovable contracts right now. Or like with Correa and Buxton, if you even wanted to trade those guys, that's a lot of money that another team is taking on to move both of those players. So not a great situation up in Minneapolis. James, how about you? What's catching your attention around Major League Baseball?
I just, as any good GM, I like to check into my players. So just seeing the way that Patrick Bailey and Jung Hoo Lee are thriving in San Francisco just warms my heart. I want the best for them. I want them to win and develop as people. So
Are you a hooligan? Is that what they're calling themselves now in San Francisco? He's got his own fan
base.
There's
a whole thing. There's only 51 of them. You have to get like admitted into like the group. You can't just declare yourself a hooligan.
Damn. Are you going to apply?
Application pending.
Is Tom Fornelli going to apply?
I imagine he would. I'm interested in the way the Giants are competing because I don't think people probably gave them a real chance to wedge themselves in between the Padres and the Dodgers, which at least they've done so far. I still am higher on the Diamondbacks than I am the Giants. They're kind of, obviously, I get updates with them from texts from Fornelli all the time. They're interesting in the sense that they're seemingly it's a fair an overgeneralization, but moving away from like an analytically minded leader of baseball operations to a former player who seems to be trying to emphasize a lot of intangible stuff that he thought was important for the last Giant dominant run. There's so much still overlap in kind of the way they build pitching staffs with the way the White Sox are starting to under Brian Bannister. And they're not like a realistic, because there's so much more revenue and so much a better stadium situation. I can't realistically see them as like an elevated version of the White Sox in kind of their mishmash of trying to develop, but also having some obligation to spend in the major market. But maybe like in some world where the White Sox were deep pocketed and, it's a similar size media market where you can imagine. But they're kind of the Cubs of the Bay Area, not the White Sox, but they're just a little bit off from the super teams where I'm interested in see how they build a sustainable winner. If and when they do, this probably wasn't the year we expect them to take a step forward, but certainly with the way they started, certainly with Jungkook Lee becoming obviously it's probably a dominant star of the league. Certainly my fantasy league, maybe he can carry them to something beyond what we pegged them for.
What was your other one, Jim?
The Orioles. Speaking of decay, or speaking of a general manager that didn't really have a next idea for how to elevate the team, and just pitching is unimpressive, and they've had injuries there, not striking anybody out. We're talking about the White Sox and just how, what between the rotation, the bullpen, they are not armed for strikeouts. But then you look at just what they're doing as a team, and it's kind of like hovering around a strikeout and inning. It's partially because they've had some long innings, and sometimes strikeouts are the only ways they get guys out, but kind of a rough estimate you're looking at. I'm looking at their numbers, 121 strikeouts over 129 innings. The Orioles are 107 over 130. Only the Marlins and Rockies have struck out fewer batters than the Orioles, and those aren't two teams you want to be compared to right now. Marlins are doing fine right now.
Yeah.
They're feisty, but in terms of just expected to compete,
the Rockies didn't even score this weekend.
Yeah, it's a case of just like the Orioles. This was maybe the pessimistic, realistic read is that you sure you don't want to pump more talent into your team? Are you sure you want David Rubenstein? You're supposed to spend more. Are you sure you don't want to put those resources here? Mike Elias, is this your prerogative in terms of being afraid to spend, being afraid to tie yourself to big contracts from outside? As who's the person most responsible for not opening up the wallets the way they thought they would be opened up? And it's interesting to watch right now, just because I think a lot of baseball fans, especially ones that are don't like necessarily the crapshoot elements of the postseason. Just get in and see what happens. The writers and the fans that cheer the Dodgers and Mets for trying to build really entertaining, deep, compelling teams. I think the Phillies are in that regard too. Phillies on the older side of it, but in terms of like adding Trey Turner and Real Muto and everything like that, same idea of just why don't we make our good team better? And the Orioles have been on the flip side of that, just in terms of, well, we project really well, or we have this next wave of prospects and, we're doing what we're doing. And the fact that the results are kind of reflecting the, I might've wanted to add more pitching. you know, it's caught my attention, and I kind of like when seeing the, you know, settling for less blow up in a team's face, because I think you know, having seen the White Sox do the exact same thing, yeah. I guess I do enjoy like that. It's not just the White Sox necessarily, but like it's a bad habit of teams to get complacent when they should be adding. And that's just something that's interesting to me.
That's going to be a league wide, everyone saying, "We told you so." If the Orioles don't bounce back, they don't make the postseason because they just don't have enough pitching to support their offense. That's going to be a very loud, "We told you so," Baltimore. Because every offseason, just like trade some of your prospects for Garrett Crochet or someone, they'll still have that chance. But right now, the Orioles are in last. They're 6-9. Yeah, I just like the division leaders right now in baseball. In the Central, it's the Tigers. They're 9-6. In the East, it's the Toronto Blue Jays. In the West, the Angels, the Los Angeles Angels, are in first place at 9-6. Way to go, Ron Washington. In the National League East, it's the Mets. National League Central, it's the Cubs. And in the National League West, it is the San Diego Padres. We all predicted this, right? These are the teams that are going to end up winning the divisions at the end of the year. I doubt it. The Angels and the Marlins are two teams that are surprising me right now to start the season. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can subscribe to Sox Machine, and when you do, you get an ad-free version of the podcast, which you get your own RSS feed. You can plug that into any podcast player, including Apple Music. It doesn't work for Spotify right now, so for Android users, go ahead and download. There's many different types of podcast players out there, but you can get an ad-free version being a Sox Machine subscriber. You can also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Sox Machine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. Follow James. He's going to be reporting for us at the games between the White Sox and the A's this week. You can follow him at JR Fegan. You can follow me at Sox Machine_Josh. And yes, we are on Blue Sky. You can become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com, and monthly plans start just $5. We have additional tiers of support. For example, this upcoming Monday night, we're having a open Zoom call with our supporters at the $25 or higher tier. So if you want direct access to James, you want to be in a group chat with James and Jim, asking questions, getting gossip and whispers of what's happening around Major League Baseball or what James is hearing from the White Sox clubhouse, go to SoxMachine.com to sign up today for one of our tiers of support. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.